my 65th birthday. So, yeah, yeah. So, and I can tell you, I've lived long enough where I can honestly testify every year it gets better. So, and that's the blessing of being a child of God, is even though your body is decaying away, the spirit is renewing, and you actually, life gets better every year. As it says in 2 Corinthians 4:16, our bodies are decaying right before our eyes, but our spirit is renewed on a daily basis. In other words, in a single day, as you heard the testimony from Dave Sargent, those two young men, in one day, their life dramatically changed. Their body decays slowly, but the spirit can change on a daily basis. So it's a thrill as a Christian to get old. The older you get, the better it gets. So, looking forward to...
That's the one.
Well, I got another birthday gift too, one I didn't expect at all, and it came from the second oldest journal of science. I can give you a trivia question. What's the oldest scientific journal in existence? Well, next to the Bible. Thank you. Well, it's a journal that's actually quite obscure today. It's called, Philosophical Transactions. It's a journal launched in Britain in the 1600s. But the second oldest journal is what's called the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And the Royal Society was an organization in Britain where they pulled together scientists and they began to publish a journal. Now, scientists are not known for their marketing abilities, but one thing that really surprised me about the proceedings of the Royal Society, for the months of June and July, they made all their research papers free to the entire public. I mean, that's an unheard of thing in the scientific literature. But they did it as a marketing move to try to get more people to subscribe to the journal. The other thing I thought was really clever on their part is they made sure that the months of June and July, they had some really stellar papers. Because as I was reading through the papers, I realized, you know, they've been saving these. These are really, and they're also written in a way that are quite readable. You know, most scientific articles are not. You have to be a specialist in the field to understand what they're saying. But as I looked at these articles, I could tell they had been edited. They took a lot of the jargon out. But remarkably, several are what I would call breakthrough papers. And I'm going to report on one of them today. The title I got for it is Thank God for Sperm Whales. But this is the paper, and you can go to the website of the Proceedings of the Royal Society. By the way, they have several different journals. They've got D for the physicists and B for the biologists. And there's an A journal and a C journal. So it comes in four. This is in the B journal. And the title of the paper is quite fascinating in itself. Iron defecation by sperm whales stimulates carbon export in the Southern Ocean. Maybe they could have used a little more editing on the title. So. Right. Now, I thought the whole article was going to be about the feces of these whales, and indeed some of it is, but actually, as you read the paper, it's a very good review of the amazing designs, unique designs you see in the sperm whale. The sperm whale is unlike any other whale we have in the planet, but it's unlike any other animal upon the planet. So there's a photograph of a sperm whale at surface. It doesn't spend much of its life on the surface. Most of its time is down deep thousands of feet. In fact, the behavior of the sperm whale is that it will dive for anywhere from 30 to 90 minutes. And then it spends about 8 minutes on the surface resting when it comes up from a dive, then it goes down again. And it's going down to feed on giant squid and colossal squid. And here's a photograph that shows the sperm whale underwater. Today, sperm whales aren't as big as they were before the whaling industry started to deplete their numbers. In fact, the sperm whale almost was driven to extinction by hunting. So this one's about 60 feet long. The longest ones you see today hit about 67 feet. But in the early part of the 19th century, they were recording sperm whales that were 80 feet long. In fact, if you go to the Nantucket Whaling Museum in Massachusetts, they have a jawbone from a sperm whale that's 18 feet long. So this is the biggest mouth of any creature. I mean, and it's all teeth. I mean, there's 28 teeth on each side of its jaw. So, T-Rex has got nothing on this creature. In fact, a single tooth weighs 2.25 pounds. Just one tooth from this creature. And here's a shot that kind of shows you what the sperm whale looks next to a human diver. And this is, again, one of the 60-footers as opposed to the ones that's 80-foot. In fact, there's one incident of a sperm whale that destroyed a whaling ship. The whaling ship Essex in 1820 was destroyed by a sperm whale, and that's what gave birth to the novel Moby Dick. There's only one time that the sperm whale won, and that was that one time. Basically used its head to keep butting the boat until it just broke up the ship. And they estimate that the sperm whale that destroyed the Essex was 85 feet long. Yes.
So how far down, what depth must they dive to find squid?
Well, typically they dive down to 3,000 and 4,000 feet. But some sperm whales have been recorded to go down as far as 9,800 feet. That's the record dive. And this is what's special about sperm whales. They're the only creature that's capable of that kind of a dive. I mean, you'd think you would get the bends. But what they've noticed about sperm whale, unlike any other mammal, they have a rib cage that will compress. And so it's a flexible rib cage. So as a sperm whale is diving down 100 feet, 500 feet, 1,000 feet, the rib cage collapses. And what that does is it forces the collapse of the lungs of the sperm whale. And that prevents it from getting the bends. Although they do notice that the older sperm whales can live to be about 70 years of age. And the older ones, you can see that their bones are pocked. And that's a symptom of bends. So they do get the bends, those that dive really deep. But they're able to survive the bends, unlike us human beings. So, and the other thing you notice about the sperm whale is that their blood supply is super enriched with red blood cells. And so what that does, it allows the sperm whale to heavily oxygenate its body. In fact, when it surfaces, it breathes really quickly for a while, and then the breathing slows down. And when the breathing slows down, that means that the whale's now packed enough oxygen into its muscles that it can literally dive down, and it can hold its breath for 90 minutes. No other mammal is capable of holding its breath for that period of time. Yes?
Why is it called a sperm whale?
It's called a sperm whale because of this thing you see in its head. Let me use this. The forehead here, the brain is actually right about in here. And by the way, it's got the biggest brain of any animal on the planet, although its brain to body mass ratio is a lot less than ours. So it's got the biggest brain. But in front of the brain is this huge sac filled with what's called spermatocete. And they call it that because it's packed with this oily substance. In fact, that's what really nearly drove the sperm whales to extinction, is that people were hunting these whales in the 19th century and using the spermatocete in the forehead of these whales as oil for lamps, and then they would actually render it down for wax. So basically the sperm whales are being driven to extinction for the oil in their foreheads. And the reason why they're called sperm whale is the oil is a white, milky substance that looks just like semen. So that's where it got its name, sperm whale. Scientists now believe that the spermatocete sac, and it's huge. I mean, it covers, goes back almost one-third the length of the animal. So it's an enormous organ inside the sperm whale. And they don't fully understand its function, but they believe it facilitates the regulation of its buoyancy, because to make a dive to go down to nearly 10,000 feet, it has to regulate the buoyancy at different steps all the way down and all the way back up, and they believe that that's done by the spermatocoete sac that's in the forehead. The other thing they notice is that the sperm whale is adapted so that during a dive, its oxygen needs are much lower than that of any other mammal. It almost kind of hibernates as it goes down. And this is the amazing thing about the sperm whale. As it's going down, its body is designed to really conserve oxygen. So the muscles don't move much. The creature goes almost into a state of sleep as it's diving. Keep in mind, it's holding its breath. I mean, you try holding your breath. I mean, what I notice is when I'm holding my breath, I'm actually probably burning up more oxygen just because you've got to stay conscious of your environment. Somehow the sperm whale has been designed so that it can actually conserve oxygen on the way down and on the way up. But the amazing thing is when it finds a squid, then the oxygen expulsion is very high because it's got a real battle on its hand once it finds one of those squid. And by the way, here's its prey. This is what it looks like. So it's not a small creature that it's hunting. So that's what's called a colossal squid. There's two kinds. The giant squid's about 30 feet long. The colossal squid's about 50 feet long. So there shows a human diver, and that's a porpoise, just to give you some idea of the size of this creature. It's got 10 tentacles. The octopus has 8. This one has 10. And it's got huge suckers all the way along it. And basically, this squid will use that to try to fend off the sperm whale. And this is what happens to the sperm whale after it ages a bit. These are scars from its battles with the giant and colossal squid. And so the sperm whale literally comes up wounded after taking on one of these giant squid. Now, the whole point, that what's amazing to me is when it's down at, say, 7,000 feet and finds one of these colossal squid, now it's in for the battle of its life to try to, you know, capture that squid as prey. And so it's using up huge amounts of oxygen. In other words, it's got to kill that squid quickly before it runs out of oxygen. The squid doesn't have to hold its breath, but the whale does. And, of course, squid are clever enough to recognize that if they can keep that whale down long enough, then they can get away or they can actually kill the whale. And so that explains all these marks here. What's happening is that the squid is really trying to make sure that it doesn't become lunch. And so this is not an easy task for the sperm whale to go down to these great depths, hold its breath, regulate its oxygen on the way down, expend lots of oxygen when it battles the giant squid, and reserves oxygen on the way up. And it literally hits the surface completely exhausted, and it has to reoxygenate its body before it can undertake another dive. Yes?
How long is the descent and how long is the ascent?
It depends. If it's only diving down, say, 4,000 feet, that might be 30 minutes. But if it's doing a really deep dive, say to 9,000 feet, then you're looking at as much as 90 minutes. And also depends what kind of battle it runs into with the squid. Now, let me take you back to this thing here. Squid today are not that big. I mean, basically, there's different figures before whaling and after whaling. In fact, that's part of this article, is that the near extinction of the sperm whales did tremendous damage to the squid. It's something that wasn't recognized until recently, that there's a positive feedback loop that I'm going to talk to you about. In other words, the more sperm whale you have, the more squid you have, and the bigger the squids are. And likewise, the bigger the sperm whales. Today, sperm whales come in at about 50 feet long. But before the whaling industry, they were coming in at 70 and 80 feet long. And likewise, the giant squids were often reported 50 feet long. Today, they're coming in at about 30 feet, 33, 35 feet max. And the problem is we don't have enough sperm whale to stimulate the growth of the giant squid and the population numbers. So it's something you wouldn't expect. And people would think, well, the sperm whale are predators, And if we, you know, eliminate the sperm whale, that should help the squids, but it's actually the other way around. So it kind of gives you an appreciation. I mean, you know, we hear about young earth creationists who think that predatory activity is bad, but this is one of the more dramatic examples of where the predators are critical to make sure you've got big, healthy squid and lots of them. Now, I'll explain, that's basically what the paper is all about, explaining how that works. And also, they've discovered in the same process, this is also true of the baleen whales, the whales that don't eat squid and fish, but eat krill instead. Yes?
Isn't it kind of murky down there? How do they find these squid?
Well, that's the other unique part of this sperm whale's design. When you're down at 1,000 feet, 3,000, 4,000, 9,000 feet, it's pitch black. There's no light there at all. And what they noticed about the sperm whale is that it uses echolocation. In other words, it basically sends out a sonar pip. And no animal sends out as loud of a sonar pip as a sperm whale. Because, you know, we know killer whales do that. You know, they'll send out a little sonar chirp to try to find schools of fish. But the chirp that's sent out by a sperm whale is deafening by comparison. And it has to be deafening because it's swimming in very dense water and it's looking for these few scattered, because, you know, it's not like the surface where you have lots and lots of light packed closely together. Down in the depths, there's not quite the food supply there is at the surface. And so a lot of what the sperm whale is doing when it makes those deep dives is trying to find the squid. It can't see them. It's pitch black. So it sends out this echolocation, basically a sonar chirp, and it reflects off the bodies of these creatures. It helps if they're big. Because they're nice and big, you can get a good echo reflection off them. And then it keeps chirping away until it locates the squid, and then it engages in battle. Yes?
Does this mean that the bat and the whale came from a LUCA?
Well, I mean, you could argue that from an evolutionary perspective, the sperm whales must be descended from bats.
Right.
But they're... Well, I mean, what this paper is pointing out... And by the way, the paper makes no commentary pro or con for evolution, but what it does do is document the unique designs that the sperm whale has that we see in no other creature. And so the question is, from an evolutionary perspective, how did it ever achieve this very powerful and very efficient and highly directed sonar capability that it manifests? Because no other creature has this. It's unique to the sperm whale. What's also unique to the sperm whale is that all of these features that allows it to do very deep diving. The fact that it can collapse its lung with respect to depth, the fact that it has this unique circulatory system that's able to pump all the muscles up with oxygen. At the same time, it's designed so that those muscles during the dive down and the dive up really don't need very much oxygen at all. And yet at the right moment, the oxygen can go to those muscles so that it can find its prey, engage in battle, and consume them and come back up to the surface. So, yes?
Does the squid at some point in its life have to come near the surface? And if it doesn't, then why does it have such highly developed eyes?
Well, I don't know.
I got the answer to that one. When you go down to those deeper depths, almost all the animals are fluorescent. They have glow. That's how they find each other for mating and stuff.
Okay.
So it's waiting for one of those animals down there to give off a glow looking for a mate, and of course that's his signal to go in there. So he does use his eyes down there to find the animal that glow in the dark. Except at that depth, almost all the animals have to glow in order to find each other to mate.
Well, one thing this paper did point out is that the giant squid will come near to the surface on occasion, but they stay down to the depths to keep away from the sperm whales. So... And people have actually run into this because the squid feed on fish. And so where the fishing supplies are low down in the depths, they'll sometimes come up to a little higher. And that explains why fishermen sometimes catch these giant squids. You don't catch them very often, but when you do catch them, it's because their deep sea food supply has been diminished, and that tempts them to come up to the surface and get some fish. And so sometimes they get caught by fishermen. Yes. Yeah.
What a magnificent beast. People should order sushi. Should think about this whale at some time. Isn't there an evolutionary land animal, like a horse or something, that's really related to the whale?
Well, the evolutionary explanation, and I'm writing an article on this for today's New Reason to Believe, so you can read about it, is that whales evolved from a land mammal similar to a hippopotamus and kind of went down to the water's edge. In fact, an evolutionist has written a book with the title At the Water's Edge, and it talks about how whales are a wonderful argument for the evolutionary model. And, how there was this hippopotamus-like creature that went down to the water's edge, then had problems sunburns, and so went into the water to keep its body cool, and gradually went into deeper and deeper water, fresh water, and then water that was partly fresh and partly salt, like at estuaries, and finally out into the oceans. Now, you actually see that in the fossil record. The first whales that you see in the fossil record are strictly freshwater whales. And then they're succeeded by whales that can live in estuaries, where the water is partly salt and partly fresh. And then eventually you get whales that are inhabiting all the oceans. And the thing about the sperm whale is it's ubiquitous. There aren't very many of them, but their habitat literally is the entire oceans of the world. The only place you don't find them is underneath the Arctic ice cap. But wherever there's surface water, because they've got to come up to the surface to breathe, and oxygenate their bodies, but literally they're in all the oceans of the world. And before the whaling industry, they were in large numbers in all the oceans of the world. So, but as I'm pointing out in this little introduction, is that there's kind of a contradiction between two sets of papers by evolutionists. If you read the conservation literature, it talks about how endangered the whales are and how subject they are to rapid extinction and how poor they are at being able to evolve and adapt. And basically pointing out that whales have enormous body sizes, very low populations relative to other species, and they only produce a few progeny per adult. And there's a long time between being able to being born and being able to actually give birth to a whale calf. And those are just a few of the characteristics that evolutionary models tell us work against the possibility for that creature evolving into anything different before it goes extinct. But the basis behind Zimmer's book, Carl Zimmer's the one that wrote the book At the Water's Edge, as you look at the fossil record, we find dozens of, quote, transitional forms for the whale. And so you see all these different species, and it looks like there's a progression from fresh water to salt water. Now, interestingly, this paper has buried within it a couple of paragraphs that addresses why that would be the case. Now, again, they're not creationists, but from a creation perspective, they demonstrate why a creator would create this sequence of whales that gradually expands the habitat to encompass the entire globe. Here's the contradiction. We see all these transitional forms, and yet whales, according to evolutionary models, would be the very poorest of all animals of being able to produce a natural transition. Now, the explanation that we put forward at Reasons to Believe for why we see so many, quote, transitional forms in the fossil record is that these are creatures that have the highest probability of rapid extinction, the lowest probability of being able to adapt and undergo any kind of evolutionary change. And the bottom line is God loves whales. And because they go extinct so rapidly, he has to keep making new ones. But he also has a secondary goal, not only to maintain whales on the face of the earth, but to step by step expand the habitat of the whales. And that's the basis of this paper, Iron Defecation. Because what these researchers, and by the way, this research took many years. It's 7 Australians and 1 German who spent their life on the Southern Ocean. They haven't done any research in the North Pacific or the North Atlantic. They've only done research in what's called the South Ocean. The South Ocean is that ring of water around Antarctica. So they're basically doing their research on sperm whales that live between 50 and 65 degrees south latitude. And the reason why they did that is that's a place where you have squid existing at great depths, and it's also the easiest place to observe the behavior of the sperm whales. And so they were studying both the sperm whales and these giant and colossal squid. And what they discovered is that these squid are very rich in iron. So there's an iron-rich prey, and you got the whales feeding on this iron. And so when the sperm whale defecates, they defecate a very iron-rich substance into the water. And the other thing they notice, and looking at, can you imagine spending years of her life just watching whales defecate? But that's exactly what they did. Dove into the water, made measurements of this stuff, and so, what you do for science, right? But the interesting thing they discovered is that, like all whales, when it defecates, it's mostly liquid. There's a little bit of solid, but it's mostly liquid. And by measuring the chemistry of the liquid defecation, they discovered that the iron is in what are called ferrous salts. Iron minerals typically are not soluble, but ferrous salts are. And so somehow, here's the sperm whale consuming this iron-rich prey, and in its digestion, it's converting all of that iron into ferrous salts. And that's into the what it defecates. And so what goes out into the ocean is this liquid filled with ferrous salts, highly soluble, and it gets distributed in what's called the photic zone of the world's oceans. The photic zone is that top layer of the ocean that's loaded with phytoplankton. Phytoplankton are the base of the food chain for all oceanic life. These would be unicellular life forms, diatoms, other kinds of creatures, cyanobacteria, that are taking carbon dioxide and water of the atmosphere and through photosynthesis, converting that into sugars, starches, and fats. In fact, about 70% of the total photosynthetic activity of the planet would be these phytoplankton living in the world's oceans. So it's the number one contributor to oxygen in our atmosphere. And so all of you here who are breathing lots of oxygen, you might want to give a word of thanks to the phytoplankton. They're the ones supplying you with the oxygen to breathe. They're also the primary remover of carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere of all life on planet Earth. So those of us that are concerned about global warming, again, phytoplankton play a critical role in drawing greenhouse gases. And keep in mind, the water vapor and the carbon dioxide are both greenhouse gases. So the process of photosynthesis pulls two greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and makes a food supply. Now, you got these mats of phytoplankton on the surface of the ocean, and like all unicellular life forms, they only live for a short period of time, and they die. And as they die, the detritus of their cellular components settles down into the bottom of the ocean. And that's basically what's feeding these characters. So, dead phytoplankton fall down to the surface, little small creatures, zooplankton, feed on that, and then you get the krill feeding on that, the fish feed on that, and eventually you get these giant squid feeding on the fish. But the base of the whole food chain at the deep depths of the ocean, because no photosynthesis happens there, what's feeding all these creatures is basically dead phytoplankton material falling down. But the number one inhibitor of the growth of these phytoplankton in the South Ocean is the lack of iron. And so this is where the sperm whale steps in. The sperm whale provides an iron fertilization source for the surface ocean. And the other thing they've observed about the sperm whale, they eat thousands of feet down. They defecate on the surface. They don't defecate at the depths. They wait till they get to the surface where they kind of reoxygenate their bodies, and that's where they defecate. So, somehow they're designed to make sure that the iron fertilization gets put into the photic zone of the surface. keep in mind, this is a creature that spends most of its life at great depths, but it goes to the bathroom only on the surface. So exactly where you want it to go to the bathroom, because that's where it's going to have the greatest impact on the fertilizing the phytoplankton that are there. Which, as you get into the paper, they said this is a positive feedback loop. You know, here we got these sperm whales feeding on these giant squid at great depth. They're very rich in iron. And then the sperm whale go to the surface. They defecate that. And by the way, they defecate 90% of the iron they consume. So only 10% is kept by them. The other 90% gets expelled into these surface waters. But what that iron does is it stimulates the growth of the phytoplankton, so you get a much bigger community of phytoplankton, which increases the rate of deposition of dead phytoplankton material down into the depths of the water, which means that the zooplankton there got more food to eat, which means the krill got more food to eat, the fish got more food to eat, and the giant squid have more food to eat. And so thanks to these sperm whales feeding on them, they actually can grow to a much larger population level and to much bigger body sizes with much healthier conditions. So this is a positive feedback loop that's a win-win-win every way around. And it's a win for the human population. What the heart of this paper is accurately calculating the degree to which sperm whales are responsible for pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and therefore giving a contribution to resolving the global warming crisis. And what they calculated, and you know, the background for this paper, by the way, what stimulated this study was a proposal by global warming proponents that we need to eliminate the whales or greatly reduce their population numbers. Their reasoning was this. When you look at these whales, they're huge mammals, warm-blooded, and they're expelling huge quantities of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And so if you said we want to help the global warming situation, if we can seriously reduce the population of the whales, that will stop them from putting all that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, what these researchers did was a net calculation. They calculated how much carbon dioxide the sperm whales pumped into the atmosphere through their breathing, and how much carbon dioxide gets removed from the atmosphere through their fertilizing the photic zone of the world's oceans. And they found that just the 12,000 sperm whales, which isn't a lot of whales, just 12,000 sperm whales pump 160,000 metric tons of carbon into the atmosphere. That's a lot of carbon, but they also calculated that they're responsible for moving 400,000 metric tons from the atmosphere through their iron fertilization of the photic zone, which means you got a net draw from the atmosphere thanks to sperm whales, just the 12,000 in the South Ocean, forgetting about all the rest of them, of 240,000 tons, metric tons are pulled out. Now, at the very end of the paper, they calculate conservatively how many tons of carbon were being pulled out of the Earth's atmosphasphere before the whaling industry really took off in 1750. And the answer they give is, I think it's, let me look it up just so I can get the number right. It's in the millions of tons. It's either 5 or 6 million. Yeah, that print here is a little bit fine. Okay, rather than get into the technical details of this, here it is. 2 million tons, metric tons, of carbon get pulled out of the Earth's atmosphere per year by the minimum estimate of the number of sperm whales that existed in the year 1750. And so at the end of the paper, what they're advocating, if you're really serious about trying to resolve the global warming crisis, the nations of the world need to get together and bring the whale populations back up to where they were before the whaling industry really got underway. And the whole point is it will not only help the global warming problem by cooling the planet because of all the carbon that the whales remove from the atmosphere. It'll also increase the krill population because they found the same feedback loop with the baleen whales. What they notice is when you take the baleen whale populations down, they were reduced to about 1% of what they were. That resulted in a catastrophic drop in the krill population because the krill were feeding on the plankton that were being fertilized by the defecation of the baleen whales. So with all the whales, you get this positive feedback loop. And that begins to impact the population of penguins and seals and all the fish that exist in that part of the ocean. And so everybody loses when you don't have whales swimming in the oceans like you did back in the 1750s. And the whale is mentioned four times in the Bible as a creature that God created to proliferate and to frolic in the oceans. That's something else that you do notice, is that these whales loved to play. And it actually mentions that in the Bible, how they were designed to frolic in the oceans. They're also designed with a strong desire to relate to human beings, which made it so easy for them to hunt. They're kind of like porpoises and dolphins. They love human contact, but consequently, that put them at great risk for being preyed upon by human beings. I'll say a little more about that in a minute. Yes.
Why is it so hard to get all these nations to stop whaling? You would think, you know, it'd be so easy, and yet we can't. You know, we got Norway, I think, Japan, and a few others, Russia maybe, that are still whaling. Why can't we stop them?
Well, there's a word for it. It's called selfishness. Another word would be greed. I mean, what you see by these nations is they would love it if everybody else would stop whaling except them. Because there's a lot of money to be made in whaling. But the whole point is that this paper points out, if we bring the whale population back up, we can sustain a whaling industry. Not at the level we had in the 19th century, but you could sustain a limited whaling industry. That would be a whole lot more than what we got right now. Right now, we let the Eskimos hunt some whales. We let the Norwegians, the Japanese, the Russians hunt whales. The Chinese do it, even though they're not supposed to do it. But you know, a few nations are allowed to hunt. Everybody else has stopped hunting. Well, I don't know whose fault it is. But what these researchers are pointing out, if we will actually invest in restoring the whale populations to where they were, then there'd be a lot more whales that we could hunt at a sustainable level. There'd be more fish in the oceans. There'd be more seals. There'd be more penguins in the oceans. There'd be more krill in the oceans. And we'd be able to pull a whole lot more carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere.
The other way is decreasing the human population.
Well, there's even a benefit there. And because, you know, research shows that if you can bring up the economic well-being of human beings, that does result in a lower birth rate. And so maybe this could help lower the human birth rate and solve that problem too. So, but the principle this demonstrates is, number one, God is the one that has designed the sperm whale to have all of its unique features. I mean, how can you explain this by some naturalistic evolutionary process? No other creature has these features. They haven't been on the scene that long in terms of the evolutionary or the fossil record. And so really to attribute all this to natural mechanism just doesn't stand up. The other thing is to recognize that God really has designed the life on planet Earth so that we run into some kind of a crisis, he's already provided a solution where you will not have to compromise your ethics or your economics. He's purposely designed things so there will always be a solution for human problems that are simultaneously economic and simultaneously ethical. And so in terms of trying to appeal to Norway and China and Russia, the Eskimos, hey, you want to get back into a whaling industry? The best thing is to restore the population of the whales. Because if we keep hunting them like we're hunting them, we're going to hunt them to extinction, and then nobody's going to have any whales, and we're going to have a real problem trying to regulate the atmosphere so it doesn't trap so much heat. Moreover, as you saw in this paper, everybody loses if you get rid of the whales. And so bringing the whales back is a win-win for everybody, including even these guys. They benefit from having the whales eating them, which again kind of helps people who think, well, you know, carnivorous activity can't be by God's hand. It must be the devil, or it must be human sin. And this is a research study that points out, no, predators really do serve a valuable purpose in enhancing the population and the lifestyle and the health of the animals they prey upon. The reason why we make the mistake of thinking that predatory activity is somehow wrong or evil is because of the way we hunt. When we hunt, we go after the best within the population. And you know, these whales aren't stupid. Trying to do battle with one of these creatures isn't an easy thing. So naturally, it's going to be looking for the squid that's not going to put up quite so much of a battle, and so it goes after the sick squid, or the squid that are a little on the old side, that are not as strong, or a little bit smaller. This enhances the health of the predatory population. So we're the only predator on the planet that can hunt any animal we want, and consequently we tend to go for the trophies, the best within the population. All the rest of the predators must be satisfied with the least or the worst within the population, and that actually enhances the health and the population levels of these species. Once again, no easy thing. By the way, I got some cool slides here of what the phytoplankton look like.
Just interject a little bit of truth in the discussion here. Is there an international treaty that banned whaling? And the problem was in that treaty, they made an exception that said nations can hunt just a few whales for research. And the problem was in that law, they didn't put a limit on how many you can collect from research. So Japan, these countries that we talked about that hunt, the way that they get around justifying it, they say, well, we're collecting these just for quote-unquote research. And of course, once they grab it for research, you don't want to waste those resources. And of course, then they sell the meat and whale and stuff. And so the people that wrote the law just didn't do a good job by putting a limit on the number for the research, obviously. And it's just so we know exactly where the law actually is, what the truth is.
Right, and you know, in one sense, this should have been done a lot earlier, because the sperm whale populations are gradually recovering, but you don't see the health or the strength or the size in these animals that existed before, because the numbers got depleted to such a degree that you wind up with a lot of inbreeding. In fact, I remember 30 years ago, they thought the sperm whales were completely gone. And the blue whales were completely gone as well. The blue whales are gradually recovering. Although both are considered to be endangered, neither the blue whales nor the sperm whales are at a population or a health level where they're not at risk of extinction. So they're both still on the endangered species list because they got hunted down to such a few individuals. There was a period of time when people who were hunting whales were not killing any blue whales at all. It's because they couldn't find them. There were so few in number, they couldn't find them. Same thing happened with the sperm whales. Okay, I saw a question in the back. Yes, Ben, over here. Yeah, go ahead.
This may be going off a little bit, but the question I was asked, I can't believe the Bible because I can't believe the story of Jonah being swallowed by a whale. How would you answer?
Well, first of all, the Hebrew word for whale is broader than whale. It would include any large animal that lives in the ocean. And so it might have been a large shark. It might have been some kind of a fish. It might have been some kind of a whale. If it's a sperm whale, even though it's got a very long jaw, it's a narrow jaw. So I would guess that Jonah would have to kind of keep his arms in like that. I mean, there's been studies on could you actually, because what it talks about in Jonah is how this big creature put Jonah in its mouth and kept it there for a period of time, then spit it on the shore. And so it's kind of similar to the story of Elijah being fed by ravens. You know, ravens don't normally do that, but this is a particular case where God sent the ravens and they literally kept Elijah fed. And, you know, that's hard work for a raven to do, to keep a robust man fed just by dropping food in front of it. But the raven was able to pull it off. So, I mean, if God can do that with ravens, I don't think it's going to be a problem to do that with a big fish. It probably would have somewhat colored the body of Jonah, because at a minimum, you've got a lot of saliva fluid in there. So even if Jonah has oxygen to breathe inside the mouth of this creature, yeah, that's why a lot of people have argued maybe it was a large mammal, because it would be on the surface, and he'd be able to, you know, keep oxygenated that way. But given that it was 3 days and three nights, his skin would have probably been quite discolored by the experience, which might have given the Ninevites a little more reason to listen to what he had to say. He probably looked quite unusual. Maybe they thought he was an alien from another planet. I don't know.
I think Pinocchio also was swallowed by a whale.
Vernon McGee said he was dead. He likens it to Christ being in the tomb for 3 days.
Yeah, some Bible people have said that it was actually a Lazarus-style situation. Because some have actually read the text to claim that he was swallowed into the stomach and therefore digested. He would have died, and then God raised him back to life. But there's no need to read Jonah that he was actually digested. He could have just been held in the mouth of the creature. So, well, I mean, if he's on the surface, there'd be oxygen supply there. Well, again, it's open. We don't know whether it's a big fish, a shark, or a whale, but the text does tell us that God used this sea creature to protect Jonah in the same fashion that he used ravens to feed Elijah, and then something happened inside the whale. Evidently, he was praying a lot. The text does tell us that while he was inside, he was conscious. So he wasn't in a state of hibernation, which makes me doubt the idea that his body was being digested, because the text actually says he was praying while he was inside this creature. And so how I interpret it is that God used this animal in the seas to protect and preserve Jonah in the same way that the ravens did that for Elijah. Or the same way that God did that with the lions in the lion's den for Daniel. And, you know, as we've been studying the book of Job, at least with the birds and the mammals and the higher reptiles, they have within them a motivation given to them by God to serve and please human beings. And therefore, it would be reasonable that some of these creatures, under the influence of God's Spirit, would take this protective role towards Jonah, Elijah, Daniel, and others. Okay, I think you're next, and we got two more questions back here.
And this is a little bit off, too. And just, I heard that oxygen in a whale, even the stomach, tend to gather the oxygen gas and salt.
Right.
But yes. A little bit off, but on the topic of whales, you mentioned that whales have a habit, in history, have a habitat of going freshwater, estuary, and then salt. And that, according to the RTD theory, that this would show multiple causes of creation. In the book More Than a Theory, there's reference to a paper, Causes of Extinction, where I wrote the authors and they said it cannot be used more than going back 15,000 years, although RTB uses it for extinction of dinosaurs and a multiple creation of dinosaurs 60 million years ago and before. But what I want to focus is sort of a two-part. I want to give your definition, because definitions are always really important. They have little variations, and you need to understand it. And then ask a question. How does the word, I believe it's Kileem or Kiai?
Kileem?
Yeah. Figure in with the RTB, then I'll ask my question.
Okay. Well, before I get to that, I didn't address how, from a biblical creation perspective, God would be motivated to gradually expand the species of whales and the different capabilities of being able to use fresh and salt water. Given the fact that its feces plays such a crucial role in fertilizing the world's oceans, as the sun is getting brighter and brighter, you'll see this in More Than a Theory, God will be intervening to ensure that you got more efficient draw from the atmosphere of greenhouse gases by life. And therefore, in that context, you can see why the Creator would not want to kind of put the whales there all at once, but gradually expand the habitat of the whales so that step by step you can increase the pulling of greenhouse gases from the Earth's atmosphere. And what this paper is pointing out is how efficiently whales can work to pull more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun is getting brighter and brighter, you're going to want to gradually pull down the capture of greenhouse gases from the Earth's atmosphere. You don't want to do it all at once. So that kind of answers the question, why would a creator take this apparently laborious process of step-by-step expanding the habitat of the whales? You can also go on our reasons.org website. There's a number of papers, articles we've written on whales, making the point that the evolutionary argument of whales, what would be strictly freshwater environment to saltwater environment, you need completely different internal organs capable of ingesting water from saltwater as opposed to water from freshwater. And you actually see that in the freshwater whales today compared with the saltwater whales. The internal organs are radically different, and trying to evolve those by natural process is a tall order, to say the least. Now, in terms of the Hebrew words, kiliyim and the word min, we did this sometime in class before, is that in Hebrew, you have the word min, which means kind. There is no word in Hebrew for species or genus or for family or order or phylum. It has this word kind, which means it's in the context of creatures reproducing after their own kind. And so what the Bible is saying is that there are these kinds that God set up with boundaries between one kind and another kind. And so people looking at the Hebrew try to say, okay, from a biblical perspective, what are the limits to evolutionary adaptation? Now, where do the min stop? Now, the word kiliyim is different from min, and it means plural. So min is only singular. I think it's about 31 or 34 times you see the Hebrew word min. It's always referring to a single kind. The word kiliyim always refers to two kinds. So it's always used for the plural. It's never used for the singular. Min is only used for the singular. It's never used for the plural. And really, the distinction of where the boundaries are is simply looking at the lists you see, particularly in the Torah, where it talks about different creatures that we would recognize as species and how they classify them as kind. For example, there's two texts, one in Deuteronomy and one, I guess I'm running out of time, one in the book of Exodus, where it identifies eight different owls as separate min. And so that's why we've concluded, in more than a theory, at least for the birds and mammals, the biblical definition of what we would consider to be a set of animals that reproduce within their own kind would be quite narrow. There are no biblical references for creatures that are neither birds or mammals. But that again fits what you see in Genesis 1, where it's got much more pointed Hebrew verbs for God creating and manufacturing birds and mammals than it does for the lower life forms. Quick comment, then we got to close.
You referred to Deuteronomy for kilayim as the plural of men, and then to help show that there's a difference between species and what the boundaries would be of species. I looked up kilayim. It is plural. It ends in im, which is Hebrew for plural. But it has nothing to do with genetics or species. It's a word that means diverse, and it applies to more than animals. For instance, in Deuteronomy 22:9-11, it mentions three different types of diversities. Plants that are don't plant with two types of seed, that's diverse seed. Do not plow with an ox or a donkey, two types, diverse animals. Nothing to do. And do not wear clothes of wool and linen, diverse. The same word is used there, and the lexicon said, don't compare this word kilayim with mean. So I'm suggesting that, yes, there's progression, but perhaps we need to reconsider, at least from the Hebrew, that progression for a theistic evolutionist may be just as strong as for one who's not theistic, that it is needed.
Well, where you see those kilayim, Steve, is where it's making the point that don't take a donkey and a horse and mate them for a mule. It says they can mate, but it does make the point that they are separate men. And so, because sometimes evolutionists will argue, well, since you can mate a horse and a donkey, that means they're part of the same common ancestor. And what the Bible is saying, okay, you can force them to mate, but this is something you shouldn't do because they really are separate men. And that, therefore, that would be a case that from a biblical perspective, it would be arguing for a narrow definition of the men rather than a broad definition. And I really wrote that not with theistic evolution in mind, but young earth creationism in mind, because they interpret the word men and the word kiliyim as being as broad as an order or a family. And based on how the two words are used, both words are used in Scripture, it would rule out that possible interpretation of the term. But it also has implications for the evolutionary models. With that, the two of you at the back, we'll pick you up next time. And hey, sorry about this taking the entire time, but it was an exciting discovery. And again, it's free. Go to the website and you can pick up a number of fascinating articles. They got an article, by the way, just like this one, on why we should be thanking God for flowering plants. And also one about the woolly mammoth. So really fascinating stuff there, and it's all free and it's quite readable. So this is a time where if you want to get into scientific literature and pretend to be a scientist, this is the best time to do it. You can do it for free. All right. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've had looking at your record of nature. And Lord, we appreciate the accounts in the Bible that talk about the whale and how much you enjoy the whale and appreciate it, and it gave it a capacity to frolic and even a capacity to frolic with us. But Father, I pray that the study we've had today would help us to realize that we need to take care of these creatures rather than abuse them, because they really were created with us in mind. So, Father in heaven, allow us to see how you've used these animals, created them specifically to give us instruction and teaching. As it says in the book of Job, go to the animals and they will teach you. Not just things about science, but deep spiritual lessons about how we should relate to you and all of creation that you've given us. In Jesus' name, amen.